My name is Peter Homer. This morning's title will be Solitude and Intimacy with God. It's somewhat difficult to pick out chapter headings from this book and topics, so I hope you're not going to be disappointed if we don't talk only about solitude and intimacy with God. There is another book of Eddie's, or letters from Westerbork, and here's a picture of this woman, in case you were wondering. You might just want to actually page through and look at her. And there's one at her desk in the next page. You may just pass that around and look at the pictures in the middle. It helps a little bit to imagine. But yesterday we were taking a look at how Eddie began her diaries at the same time she began some therapy. She'd always thought maybe she should be a writer. And embracing her writing and the whole process of journaling helped to turn her inward and slow down. And at that time, began to have a relationship with God. She calls herself a kneeler in training. And yet she has seen her spirituality and her time spent with herself in reflection and writing as necessary and a means to strengthening and equipping her for what's going on outside. And as we noted yesterday, what's going on outside is pretty horrible in that the Jews are increasingly being restricted. And I imagine you're aware, but today, among other things, they're not allowed to, as we get into this section of the diary, they've lost their privilege to ride the trolleys, or to own bicycles, to visit each other in each other's homes, to shop in certain stores. They're now wearing the yellow star. And as time goes on, no travel's allowed between cities. And really the process of call-ups with what you can and can't bring to go to the transport can't have begun. But life is increasingly restrictive for the community. Slowly, we're going to pick up here, and before I get to a Xerox, just a few things about what she is finding in her her relationship to her inner life. We noted a little bit yesterday that when we were talking about our prayer life, that our intimacy with God is probably one of the things we talk about the least. She writes on page 110, beginning on 109, in the middle of the paragraph on 109, Good Friday morning, it's in the book but not on your sheets. Something I've been wanting to write down for days, perhaps for weeks, for which a sort of shyness or perhaps false shame has prevented me from putting into words. A desire to kneel down sometimes pulses through my body, or rather it is as if my body had been meant and made for the act of kneeling. Sometimes in moments of deep gratitude, kneeling down becomes an overwhelming urge, head deeply bowed, hands before my face. It has become a gesture embedded in my body, needing to be expressed from time to time. And I remember the girl who could not kneel, and the rough coconut matting in the bathroom. When I write these things down, I still feel a little ashamed, as if I were writing about the most intimate of intimate matters, much more bashful than if I had to write about my love life. But is there indeed anything as intimate as man's relationship to God? I really love her honesty. I've been meaning to write that. She can't even get it around to writing it in her diaries. I've been meaning to write this down, and really, as far as we know, no one ever read these diaries till much later. And someone did mention last evening that, well, maybe she kind of figured somebody would read them sometime. But, you know, she has a hard time even admitting that this intimacy with God is something she can even talk about. I feel a little ashamed as I'm writing down the most intimate of intimate matters. Is that healthy or unhealthy? What do you think? Do we go blabbing our love life to people?
We're socializing.
No. So in a sense, we don't have to be... and yet, if you don't, how's anybody ever going to know about what I think is a very... I suppose there's books on sexuality and how to do it. Intimate. How many books are there on intimate prayer life? Intimate relationship with God? I mean, not a lot. If you think about it. That's one of the gifts, I think, of this book. In the sense that it follows somebody through that process. And we get to kind of look over her shoulder and see what it's about. And for that, I'm thankful. Moving ahead, I picked out three things that I think are reasons for the reflecting, journaling, pausing process, which we're calling the inner life, I think. If we want to define it, it's not just meditation, it's not just prayer. I think it's a combination of stopping, writing, pondering, praying. These diaries represent a whole process, I think, of stopping to be with oneself in a variety of ways, intellectually, spiritually. But why do that? Why take? But they are one thing they have in common is that they're alone. These are kind of solitary things. And jumping quite quickly, three things that I can see, and see if you can pick them up. She writes on page 113, if you have a book. This is not Xeroxed. This morning, early, I knelt down in the living room among all the breadcrumbs on the carpet. Now, if I should have to say aloud what I said in my prayers, it would go something like this. O Lord, this day, this deed, it seems so heavy to me. Let me bear it well to its end, through the multitude of days. This day will probably be no heavier than any other day, but my strength to bear it is not so great. And then there is the anxiety and the burden of wondering what this summons to S from Lippmann and Rosenthal really means. But Lord, help me not to waste a drop of my energy on fear and anxiety, but grant me all the resilience I need to bear this day. German soldiers were already drilling in the skating club, and so I also prayed, God, do not let me dissipate my strength, not the least little bit of my strength, on useless hatred against these soldiers. Let me save my strength for better things. She approaches the day not feeling very strong. What are the two things she talks about that she wants to get rid of? Fear and hatred. She acknowledges these feelings. Gee, I wonder what's going to happen. But I can't afford to be afraid about this. And she sees a soldier is marching outside the window, and yet I can't use the emotional energy to hate these people. The day is going to demand too much of me. So in her solitude, she kind of collects herself to go out into this world, making some choices about how she will be. She's asking God, don't let me worry. Don't let me hate. And to me, there's a real two-pronged benefit in that for her. God is instructive to me. Don't hate, don't fear. That's part of it. I mean, we would acknowledge that. But there's also a plea for God's assistance and strength to do so. So God is helpful in two ways to her at this point, as goal, as instructor, as revealer of truth, and as the one to whom she will call upon the strength. Plus, they acknowledge she doesn't have a lot of strength today, and a real honesty to that. And I like that. That one thing she does in her solitude. Another one on page 126. At the bottom. And I really like this one as a parish pastor. We are like chemicals, processed all day long and constantly compounded with other materials. One great continuous process. But which part of you is the original element? It's almost frightening when you suddenly start to think about such matters, that you pass through the many hours of the day, and at the end you are a different person from the one you were at the beginning, because you interact with so many different people. Going back a sentence, context with others invariably alter you, even if only a little. Do you agree with that? So it's not like we can say our prayers in the morning and like be pure all day. And she, you know, she said her prayer, "Give me strength." Well, I imagine this is kind of a retrospect prayer or thought here. That, gee, as I met you or talked to you or talked to you or experienced this or that, I mean, what I started out is altered. To me, one purpose of solitude is kind of like to take a look back and see, where was I today? What was good? What was bad? Some traditions really recommend a morning quiet time and meditation, and then at the end of the day, kind of a looking back. Well, an inventory, if you will, about where was I, and what was good, what was bad, and where have I come. A third thing, and another purpose for solitude on page 127. Bit by bit, you must learn this too, 2 p.m. On those days when you feel physically out of sorts, don't hit out and make trouble for those around you. People are really much too ready to do that. Feeling wretched and continually taking out on those around them. We must find out how to come to terms with our own bad moods without making others suffer for them. Huh? That's pretty good advice here. So what does she recommend? I am gradually learning to control myself. Right now I feel like some animal that wants only to creep into a quiet corner and lie there hugging itself. That's quite a good feeling, not to want to hit out, but to stay quietly curled up in some corner. And also not to let your thoughts and feelings spill out everything around you. I used to do this all the time. Then I would poison everything that came near me, everything that came to my head, everything I set my eyes on with my bad feelings. Now I know how to isolate and accept that mood and make sure it causes no more trouble. Such days are really very trialing, but one must grow more and more independent of one's body. I've heard this phrased in another way. Pause when agitated. Go to another site and collect. Another reason for solitude. What is she saying here? The people get in bad moods.
Own it.
Own it, and what's her defense against that? It's not only bad enough to feel bad, but what do we usually do? We usually...
Change everything else.
Yeah, yeah. Is that true?
Sure is.
That's true. I think of proposing a word. Solitude is important. To go crawl off and lick your wounds. if maybe you won't feel a whole lot better, but at least she's saying you will not poison those around you. So solitude is not always some trip to Nirvana. Sometimes it's just pulling in for a while and acknowledging and owning your bad mood, and at least not poisoning somebody else with it. It's kind of like counting to 10 when you're angry. It's a discipline. I'm learning to control myself. Sometimes it's better, and my spouse tells me this, not to say what's on your mind. You don't want to hear what's on my mind right now. And we should respect each other. And especially in our intimate relationships, I think. I'm going to a solitude place right now because I think I need to be there. Very good instruction. Because we're liable to get something irrational if we're not feeling very good, emotionally or physical, that's going to be poisonous. And healing, I think, begins to take place in private then. Two more things on this solitude here. Page 139. 18th of May, 1942. The threat grows ever greater, and terror increases from day to day. I draw prayer around me like a dark protective wall, withdraw inside it as one might into a convent cell, and then step outside again, calmer and stronger and more collected again. I can imagine times to come when I shall stay on my knees for days on end, waiting until the protective walls are strong enough to prevent my going to pieces altogether, my being lost and utterly devastated. As the terror around goes up, she feels the need to go into the dark protective wall of prayer, which sounds like escapism. To me, the key word is then step outside again. Calmer, stronger, and more collected. So the rougher it gets, the more she feels she's going to have to find the refuge of her prayer life and her connection to God. And she imagines it may be a lots of prayers the tougher it gets. Why? Because she has to get away from all that? No, but if she's going to live in the world with its craziness, with any kind of calmness, with any kind of strength, she's going to have to do that. And that certainly is not what I do. You know, I got 100 things to do today. I better move extra fast. Who has time? Better not journal today because... Is that true?
Yeah.
Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's true. It's certainly true for me. I try to keep a journal, but it's pretty sporadic. But I have actually had the experience of being very angry and not letting the people that I knew know that I was angry, and just being with them, taking that time right then. And it took this particular time I'm thinking about. It took me about an hour. It was very really revealing of myself and my relationship to creativity, actually. But this is back in the other reading, the 127. And now I know how to isolate and accept that mood and make sure it causes no more trouble. The naming of it, the acceptance of it, then it's amazing what can open up for you. So if you take that time, it's really, all of this stuff is so self-serving in a way, because if you take the time, then that's gone. You've dealt with it properly, and you're not stewing about those people that got really angry an hour ago. There's been a revelation, and your energy, my energy, is freed up.
I'm glad you used anger.
And of course, it would apply even more so to fear. I think it's much more paralyzing than anger in some ways.
Jesus, what did he do with the demons? How? He called them by name. How do you know my name? And when he named the demon,
they were exercised. And I think you said it, identifying and naming the demon sometimes. A couple things about anger. But, all right, anger versus resentment. What's the difference between anger and resentment? Is there?
Well, anger is something that you experience immediately.
Yeah.
Resentment is the wrong way of dealing with it. Of harboring it and being angry forever and ever.
Yeah, Reese, it comes from the French. To feel. Uh-huh. To re-feel. Uh-huh. Resentment is to re-feel the anger again and again and again. And if we stop and deal with the anger, name it, own it, identify it, kick the cat, whatever, or the wall, then we're liable not. And if there's something we have to do with someone, we do it, rather than refeeling it and refeeling it and refeeling it and refeeling it. But it takes some time. Another quick, I'm just taking a little thing. Anger is a secondary emotion. We're always angry at or because. Anger does not attack us like if I hit my thumb. That's hurt. I am angry. Anger comes from hurt, from fear, and when I put my 27th quarter in the pot machine, I am
frustrated.
Right? right? That's when anger comes. If I stop and collect, I've tried this sometime. Why am I angry? Because I have been trying to teach you, and you will not. I am frustrated, and I am also afraid that you're never going to get it. And if you're blowing me off and paying no attention to me, I am hurt. Sometimes it's all of the above. But if I can unpack that into its components, frustration, fear, and then it's a little easier. But that takes some reflection. That takes pausing when agitated. And that's something that's an inside job. Because our emotions are different than feelings. If the sun came out, we would all feel warm. That's feelings. Now, if we are happy about that, that's an emotion. We could be sad about that because we wanted everybody to stay inside and sleep and read today. That's a value judgment if it's sunny out, or if it's snowing, or if it's raining. If it rained, there's plenty of people around here saying, great, it's not going to be fires this summer. And I'm staying up here. I'm only up here for a couple of weeks. Darn. How we feel about something emotionally is a value judgment. Emotions are value judgments. We don't feel happiness, we don't feel like we feel twinges and coldness, and we are making emotions are inappropriate or appropriate. The examined life puts the right emotion with something.
Some, what about grief? Which is that?
Kind of emotion.
Is grief a feeling or an emotion? And is it a natural thing or a value judgment?
What do you think?
I'm pondering that as your job.
Grief.
Isn't grief a natural reaction to loss? Or can you get to be so spiritually liberated that any loss doesn't bring on grief anymore?
That would be spiritually liberated.
No, it wouldn't be.
No. Oh, I think it's a... It's not like we invent the... We could choose to say, oh, it doesn't matter, which would be inauthentic. Sometimes the appropriate feeling is grief. Sometimes the appropriate feeling is joy. Not like in Babette's Feast. I mean, who was here last night to see that? What was the appropriate feeling towards that dinner, you know? Is this the devil's work? Or is this the Feast of Victory? And the appropriate emotion was being fought for there. It exists, I believe, but sometimes we have faulty emotions.
Well, I think of emotions the way you're talking about them.
as a way of reacting. Feelings are a way of receiving something. Maybe I'm not expressing this very well. Mm-hmm. But emotions are a way of reacting to something. And because it's a reaction, there's a matter of how you frame it. And you can reframe it.
Appropriate or inappropriate?
Even if you don't use the word appropriate, it's just a matter of how you happen to react, how you happen to be framing it at that time.
Okay, yeah. And that's going to be very helpful when we get on a little farther here. Because Addie begins to frame her situation in some rather extraordinary ways, to, at least to me. But I think one of the reasons she is able to look at her world and herself in some, what I would call, expansive ways is because she has practiced some solitude and been more than reactionary and reactive, but she has pondered her reactions. Like in her morning prayer, I could be afraid, I could be hateful, but no, I don't want to have those emotions. I would rather turn them over to God and have strength. We only got so much emotional strength. And I can choose to be frustrated, or I can choose to be, you know, hopeful. Or I there's some things we can do there. Moving right along, because I do want to get to some of her content, if you will. I just 138. If you have your pencil out, you might ponder this. I couldn't let it go by. I don't know how it fits in today. She says in the middle paragraph, in 138, and it's right to feel sick and confused and unsettled for once, like today, full of cold fear and uncertainty and a sigh of, good God, child, what are you letting yourself in for? But also a growing sense of self-certainty. I have matured enough to assume my destiny, to cease living an accidental life. Jumping down to the end of that paragraph. It is no longer a romantic dream or a thirst for adventure or for love, all of which can drive you to commit mad, irresponsible acts. No, it is a terrible, sacred inner seriousness, difficult yet at the same time inevitable. What's the difference between living an accidental life and one of a sacred inner seriousness?
Accidental, sir. Happens. And you might have a response, but I guess when I hear what she has recognized for herself, that it's not accidental, does that mean she's got a responsibility to somebody other than herself, which in this case would be God? So it's not just, it's accidentally happening, and I'm responsible for myself, and that's it. There's a greater plan.
A sense of destiny. Destiny. Mm-hmm. My life is not accidental, but I'm becoming to see a serious sacred. Not that we should walk around like Kierkegaard all the time, but what is my serious thing to do today? But as you say, it's not just to me. I have a sense of destiny. That certainly was a little bit about that movie last night. what was the original plan, if you will, for life and goodness? In the fact that what should have been was that Babette, you know, should have been cooking all her life that way, and perhaps the one gal should have been singing to the angels, and another one should, and the romance between the soldier and the other sister maybe should have been the way it was. That was destiny, and yet the redeeming part of that film is his destiny was fulfilled at the end, to me. The sacred seriousness of these people's lives, which for a variety of reasons hadn't happened, but was redeemed. And so she wants to be true to that. Now I'm moving to Xerox pages, if you got them. And we're on 158, I believe. You have that one? First, at the top of 159, I can't take in how beautiful this jasmine is, but it is simply enough simply to believe in miracles in the 20th century. And I do, even though the lice will be eating me up in Poland before long. She's been sitting on her balcony looking at jasmine, which is a vine with beautiful white flowers and fragrant flowers, looking out her window, just enjoying the jasmine. I take how beautiful this jasmine is, and at the same time, she's thinking about the lice eating her up in Poland before long. And then in that context, she writes what follows. It is possible to suffer with dignity and without. I mean, most of us in the West don't understand the art of suffering and experience a thousand fears instead. We cease to be alive, being full of fear, bitterness, hatred, and despair. She's proposing there's an art to suffering, and in the West, we don't understand it. Our suffering is a thousand fears, hatred, and despair. God knows it's only too easy to understand why, but when we are deprived of our lives, are we really deprived of very much? We have to accept death as part of life, even the most horrible of deaths. And don't we live an entire life each one of our days, and does it really matter if we live a few days more or less? I am Poland every day on the battlefields, if that's what one can call them. I often see visions of poisonous green smoke. Now, where she came up with that, I'll never know. Because, I mean, that's what happened, but she had no...
Some people escaped and met
it. I don't think, according to her, she ever heard that. I think this is purely mystical vision here. But that's scary. Visions of poisonous green smoke. I am with the hungry and the ill-treated and the dying every day. But I am also with the jasmine and with that piece of sky beyond my window. There is room for everything in a single life, for belief in God and for a miserable end. Is that how we believe? I mean, is not the fundamental theological problem theodicy? That it, suffering of God, theodicy. Why does God let bad things happen to good people? Why does the good King Josiah get killed? Why did God's people get thrown in the ovens? Why is there suffering if God is good? Why do the good suffer? Theodicy. The why is there suffering and evil for God's people? Why do good things happen? Bad things happen to good people. If there's a God, why does he let this stuff happen? How can there be a God in Auschwitz at the same time? And she is saying there is room enough for belief in God and a miserable end. And isn't it just our human nature to say, why are you letting this happen to me, God? Whether it's the death of someone, or disappointment, or serious illness, or it's a very natural reaction to say, and it was an old one too, if you're suffering, you must have done something wrong. In fact, Jews, you know, if that was the whole conflict when Jesus, you know, came with sinners, the sinners obviously, you know, had done something wrong, and therefore, you know, they deserved what they were getting. The poor were sinners, and then the Pharisees would separate themselves from the poor because, you know, hey, you know, they deserve what they got. They were being punished for their sin. The old Deuteronomy covenant that if you're good, God will bless you, and if you're evil, God will curse you. To which the book of Job is written in response, by the way, quite late. But that's been a question. And Job is the whole question of theodicy. But to me, that is the theological question. How can we believe in a God? And that takes us to the cross. The cross itself is, you know, why would God let this happen? That his only son would be killed. To me, the key issue is of the faith is suffering. To the point, I would just say,
culturally, once again, our friend Soren Kierkegaard, who writes on the subject of suffering. We men are prone by nature to regard life in this way. We consider suffering an evil, which in every way we strive to avoid. And if we succeed in this, we think when our last hour comes, we have special reason for thanking God that we have been spared suffering. We think that everything depends upon slipping through life happily and well. Isn't that a pretty common attitude that we think? She's saying there's room for both. Where's she going to go with that? let's keep reading. When I say I've come to terms with life, I don't mean I've lost hope. What I feel is not hopelessness, but far from it. I've lived this life 1,000 times already and have died 1,000 deaths. Am I blasé then? No, it's a question of living life from minute to minute and taking suffering into the bargain. And it is certainly no small bargain these days. She's not going to see suffering as an aberration. It's a part of life. She says, does it matter if it's the Inquisition that causes people to suffer in one century, in war and pogroms in another, to suffer senselessly, as the victims would put it? Suffering has always been with us. Does it really matter in what form it comes? Is she just being fatalistic here, or is she onto something? What do you think?
Pretty realistic.
I think that there's some place in the Bible where it says that you're not going to be rewarded here on this earth. In fact, if you follow me, you're going to suffer. And to the people that Martin Luther King, Gandhi, not a Christian, but a highly religious man, friends I have in the peace movement who regularly go to jail and suffer, this one particular man I know, it's like meeting Jesus. I've met him 3 times in my life. He's just transformed my life. He's living. He is living. And he lives in discomfort. And Martin Luther King was living, but he knew he was going to die just before he died, I think.
Oh, we were reminded, you know, when he came to Chicago, he made preparations for his funeral. I mean, she goes on to say, turning the page, to 160. All that matters is how we bear it and how we fit it into our lives. It's a given. And we can either run away from it or we can try to fit it into our lives. And then she says, am I merely an armchair theorist safely ensconced behind my desk with my familiar books around me and my jasmine outside? Is it all theory never tested in practice? I don't think so. All our conversations are now interlaced with sentences such as, I hope he'll still be there to enjoy those strawberries with us. They are really on the edge here, whether they're going to make it or not. Jumping to the end of that paragraph, right below 3 July, in the parentheses, I know that this too is part of life, and somewhere there is something inside me that will never desert me again. Somehow she's gained the certainty of faith to which she goes when she builds that little wall to climb into to get strength that's not going to desert her, which enables her to look suffering in the eye and talk about bearing it. And then very incredible passage, July 3rd, 42. Fourth line down, I must admit a new insight into my life and find a place for it. What is at stake is our impending destruction and annihilation. We can have no more illusions about that. So her, like, facing suffering isn't taking, you know, the gas chambers are part of it. They're out to destroy us completely. We must accept that and go on from there. Today I was filled with terrible despair, and I shall have to come to terms with that as well. Even if we are consigned to hell, let us go there as gracefully as we can. I did not really want to put it so blandly. Why this mood at this particular moment? It's because I have a blister on my foot from walking through the hot town. We'll get back to that. Jumping down to the middle of the next page.
Very well then, 161. This new certainty that what they are after is our total destruction, I accept it. What does it mean to accept something?
You're not fighting it any longer.
It certainly doesn't mean like, right?
Right. You make use of that suffering to enrich your life yourself.
Yes. To accept something means not to live in denial about it, right? Certainly doesn't mean to like it. If somehow I were to fall down the mountain and become paralyzed, I would have to learn to accept that. I would never have to like it. But if I denied it, I'll walk again, or my life is over, or, you know, all the options one might have on acceptance. Now she's accepted this fact, which doesn't mean she's necessarily resigned to it, welcoming it. Now, the question's going to become, well, should she go into hiding, get a gun, or what? I mean, that's another question, though, isn't it? And I think we got to take a look at that. But accepting inevitability of something brings on despair. But she accepts the fact finally, hey, they're really out to destroy us all. I'm not going to live in denial about that. And yet she can keep right. Then what does she write? I will work and continue to live with the same conviction, and I find life meaningful, yes. Now, hear this. Living and dying, sorrow and joy, the blisters on my feet and the jasmine behind the house, the persecution, the unspeakable horrors, it is all as one in me. And I accept it all as one mighty whole and begin to grasp it better, if only for myself, without being able to explain to anyone else how it all hangs together. I wish I could live for a long time, so that one day I may know how to explain it. And if I'm not granted that wish, well, then somebody else will perhaps do it, carry on from where my life has been cut short. And that is why I must try to live a good and faithful life to my last breath, so that those who come after me do not have to start all over again, need face the same difficulties. Isn't that doing something for future generations? How she can write this just destroys me. I mean, talk about an intuition if my life is cut short. But why is she worried her life's going to be cut short? Because she's not going to live? No, because she will not have fulfilled her purpose, which is the people after her don't have to start all over again. And what is her insight? This word whole, right? Joy and sorrow, blisters and jasmine. Is a whole. She refuses to see her life as pleasure is good and everything else is evil and to be avoided. She is able to embrace life on life's terms and not be overwhelmed by that which is going on around her. And she can't explain how it all hangs together, but that is what her statement of faith, I think, is all about. I am so prone to say, when things don't go well, well, what's wrong? What did I do wrong? Working with people, that happens a lot. Or when a child doesn't turn out the way we want them to, maybe they do make mistakes with their lives. What did I do wrong? Well, is that the way to ask the question? As if I can control my children or people or things? That if I'm suffering and things are, if I'm sad or if something evil is happening, I can either fight that, blame it, try to explain it, or I can embrace it. It's just part of being alive today. I mean, it could be que sera sera, the worst case, but I think it's more than that. It's embracing both the good and the bad, both the joy and the sorrow as a whole. And all is not joy, and all is not sorrow. That's what we're invited to think about here. The fact that this person can see so much joy is beyond me. I mean, God, I'd be terrified. And yet to me, the real victory is, and in America, you know, we're like these people, Kierkegaard. If we can get through life with no sorrow or suffering, it was a good life. And by and large, we live those kind of lives. Which is why they say teenage suicide is such a high thing lately. They say that these kids are not used to getting things not work out for them. So that when something doesn't go well for them, they don't know how to handle it. And the only choice they have is to pow. They have not lost and been disappointed enough in their life to know what that's about. And, you know, at least this 60s parents is so indulgent of his children. It's ridiculous. I mean, every generation wants it easier for the next, I think. And I know my folks wanted that for me. And my, I grew up in the 60s when, you know, 50s and 60s, where this land was producing everything. And I want the same for my children. And discipline and saying no and disappointments and suffering. I think we want to spare people from that. When perhaps real moral education and Christian education is service and suffering. And learning how to embrace that as part of our life. When I do marriage counseling, anybody can stay married while things are going well. It's when you can't stand each other, or you lose your job, or someone's ill, or it's when the crap happens. That's when the marriage is tested. If Christianity is one big waltz through the tulips, hey, fine. It's when the faith is tested. I got in the margery here about I must admit a new insight into my life and find a place for it. I've got cancer. Now there's a, or I, my aunt is dying, or my daughter is, you know, left home and is never coming back again, at least for today. I have to accept that. I have to make room in my self for that reality. And at the same time, hopefully not let that devastate me. Because according to Eddie, there's more to life than that. She goes on, if you want to continue here. or any comments? I don't want to cut you short here.
Where are we going now?
We're going on, let's see here. I'm going to, where, do you have 161? What do you got? 164, your next page? Mm-hmm. Let me see if there's something on 62 I wanted to mention here. She has a whole thing on death here that I want to read a little bit for you. 162, if you've got a book at the bottom. By coming to terms with life, I mean the reality of death has become a definite part of my life. My life has, so to speak, been extended by death. By my looking death in the eye and accepting it, by accepting destruction as part of life, and no longer wasting my energies on fear of death or the refusal to acknowledge its inevitability, I mean, we're back to this fear thing. She's accepting her death, whether it's by the Holocaust or whatever. It sounds paradoxical. By excluding death from our life, we cannot live a full life. And by admitting death into our life, we enlarge and enrich it. And that's just wonderful Kierkegaardian Lutheranism, right? Christianity, the cross. He who seeks to save his life will lose it. He who loses my life for the gospel will save it. We have to, and the whole baptismal thing, we must die and rise. The life I no longer live is my own. I live it unto God. I have died, Paul says. This whole death thing. Whereas, we'll continue here. On to 164 and 5.
top of 165. You have that one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fifth line down. Throughout the ages, you got that? Throughout the ages, people have been tired and worn out their feet on God's earth in the cold and the heat. And that, too, is part of life. This sort of feeling has been growing much stronger in me. A hint of eternity steals through my smallest daily activities and perceptions. I am not alone in my tiredness or sickness or fears, but at one with millions of others for many centuries, and it is all part of life. Just going back to 64, and all this because of one little blister on my foot. Remember that a couple pages ago? She gets a blister on her foot, and this one little thing gets her thinking about, hey, throughout the ages, people have been tired and worn their feet out on God's earth. It's not like, oh, why'd this happen to me? Isn't it terrible? We can't take the buses anymore, and we have to get blisters on our feet, and ain't it awful? And it's a cruel world, and why those terrible Germans are doing this, and I need better shoes, and why? No. Throughout the ages, people have been tired. Shut up and adjust. There's an acceptance here to, like, hey, life is difficult. I'm not the only one that ever got tired. Putting in a hard day's work's okay sometimes, because, hey, millions of people have done it. Rather than whining, she is, hey, I'm just like millions of people. And rather than feeling selected and isolated, she feels part of the great human enterprise. And right before that, I thought, or rather I didn't really think it, it welled up somewhere inside me. Yesterday we were talking about the difference between thinking and listening. I didn't think this thought. It welled up from within inside me. It bubbled up. And it's a gift then. And that's another reason I think, you know, hey, what are meditation and being open to receive the things? That's an image, though, welling up. Then she goes on to talk about as life becomes harder and more threatening, next paragraph. It also becomes richer because the fewer expectations we have, the more the good things of life become unexpected gifts, which we accept with gratitude. As she lowers her expectations about what should and ought to be, the more she has gratitude. At least that's how I feel. And we can tell each other from time to time how strange it is that we feel no hatred or indignation or bitterness, but we can't say that openly in company, for no one would understand. During our walk, I knew that a house was waiting for us at the end. But I also knew that a time would come when there would be nothing like that, and all our walks would end in some barracks. I knew this while we were walking, knew it would be only true not only for myself, but for all the others, and I accepted that too. She's living in the present, but she's not divining the future. On to, almost in conclusion, 166 and 167. I don't know how this exactly fits into this great insight into embracing suffering, but... the situation is Eddie takes long walks with his fellow Spier. How would you say that? S-P-I-E-R? Spier? Spier? Yeah, okay. Spier, who's her lover, but who has many friends. And evidently, Spier loves to walk. And yet, Eddie's not a real strong physical specimen. And... she gets kind of worn out. She's got a blister on her foot, and yet she really loves this guy and realizes he loves his walks. And she knows her other friend, Ty, you know, walks and is a real good walker. And so this is the setting of this comment here. On the bottom of 166. By last night, I had not plucked up enough courage to say that I could not walk so far, for I know that to him such walks are relaxing, and I also thought something like, Tide can walk with him for hours. so I should be able to do it too. It's the same old childish fear of losing another's love if one doesn't meet all his expectations. But I am ridding myself more and more of these feelings. One must be able to admit one's inadequacies, even in the physical sphere. And one must also be able to accept the fact that one may not always be for another just what one would like to have been. That's some pretty big maturity, especially for a male. I can't walk that far. I can't lift this. I can't do that. And I can't be for my wife or my children everything I would like to be, or for you as your teacher, maybe. That's tough admission. However, top 167, to admit one weakness is not the same as complaining about them. For complaining means shifting the misery onto others. And that, there's a real nice difference between admitting weakness and complaining. Jumping down, what's a better way to look at this? It's all in my mind, that paragraph, middle of the page, of course, but now I say quite simply and candidly, look, my strength isn't up to it. I can't go any further, and there's nothing I can do about it. You must take me as I am. This is just one more step towards maturity and independence. I seem to be getting a little closer every day. I like that. There's big grace there, huh? I can't do everything. My strength isn't up to it. You must take me as I am. what that really means is I must take me as I am. At least that's the kind of person I am. I'm not going to let you see my vulnerability. I think people are more than gracious. If I were blind and asked you to lead me out the room here, you'd be more than willing. But my macho pride would try to want to fake it there, you know. It's that way. Before we break, which is in just about 1 minute, somebody talked about gaining strength. At top of 176, I want to ponder this in the couple days before we get back together. Top of 176, you have that, Xerox? And you can draw strength even from suffering. Top of 176. You have to be consistent to the end. You can say, I can bear everything else, but if something were to happen to him or if I had to leave him, then I couldn't go on. But even in that case, you simply have to go on. You must learn to forgo all personal desires and to surrender completely. And surrender does not mean giving up the ghost, fading away with grief, but offering what little assistance I can whenever it pleased God to place me. Once again, she's asking us and herself to have the capacity, if you will, to have more than one feeling at a time. Surrender does not mean give up. It's more like advanced acceptance. Surrender. Surrendering to God can be very liberating. Surrendering to sorrow can be very liberating. And allowing its proper place in our lives. Who is Jesus? The man of constant sorrows and acquainted with grief? Isn't that what he's described as? He had the capacity to look at Jerusalem and weep, oh, that I might gather you under my arms. And yet, did that incapacitate him? No. Do we have the capacity to do that?
Not on our own, but yeah.
Potentially, we do. What prevents us from that?
Our egos.
Our egos. You know what ego means? E-G-O? Easing God out. Pretty good, huh? Easing God out. Our egos and our fear rather than faith. I can't handle this. I don't know what I would do in the context if she lose spirit. No, I would have to go on. I would have to surrender and find out how I can continue to be useful even though I'm in grief. you know, grief does destroy our lives, but not ultimately. It doesn't destroy our lives. I say that too strongly. It does impact and cripple and handicap and disable our lives, but it does not destroy our life.